Well, this is a little different this morning. Not only am I service leader, but I'm going to do some presenting. And I'm going to give some of my own thoughts, short thoughts on Remembrance Day. And then Helen found a couple of sermons by Reverend Brian Kiley, whom some of you know from the Unitarian Church of Edmonton, and she adapted them and put them into one piece here that I'll read. And then I think we probably have some memories and some thoughts that we'd like to share amongst ourselves. When I was growing up in small town Northern Ontario many decades ago, Remembrance Day was a big deal. There were many veterans of the two world wars in town, including my father and many others. Strangely, as is still the case, Remembrance Day, although observed in Ontario, is not a statutory holiday. Easter Monday is a stat holiday, but Remembrance Day is not. And the reverse is true in Saskatchewan. Because of this, my hometown had its Remembrance Day ceremonies on the Sunday closest to the actual day. At this time, regulations were much more stringent, and having the Legion Bar open after the parade and cenotaph ceremonies was not permitted. And the Legion branch opened the bar anyway with no repercussions until another local Legion branch asked why their organization could not open their bar on Sunday when the Capriol branch had been doing it for years. You can guess the rest. I myself have mixed feelings about Remembrance Day as time has passed, and I've had the chance to ponder the sentiments involved. I can't get away from the feeling that the military going to war is being glorified. Talk of worthy sacrifice abounds. They shall not grow old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. The military, like the police, I suppose, are a necessary evil. In a perfect world, we would not need such organizations. Sadly, history has shown that we do need them. But I think more emphasis needs to be put on the horrors of war, not the glorious sacrifice. After years of wearing the blood-red poppy on my lapel, I think I'm favoring the white poppy being promoted by Regina's own peace activist, Florence Stratton. I just am not comfortable with the thought of glorifying war, and the white poppy is a way of expressing that sentiment. Those are some of my personal musings, and now I'm going to read the extracts and adaptation of the two sermons that Helen found by Brian Kiley. The first extract comes from a sermon on Remembrance Day that Reverend Kiley gave at the International Council of Unitarians and Universalists in 2007. Here, Reverend Kiley focuses on all who are involved in war, soldiers, civilians, and family members of soldiers who died in war, as follows. Is Remembrance Day about honoring sacrifice or glorifying war? When we talk of peace and war, we are talking about the politics of nations. When we speak of Remembrance Day, we are speaking of the stories of individual men and women sucked up in the national issue. But their stories and their sacrifices are deeply personal. Whether one agrees with war or not, most can agree that war exacts a terrible toll on the participants, soldiers and civilians alike. the goal of Remembrance Day is to honor those stories and those sacrifices in hope that no more young men and women will ever have to make them again. In recent years, historians in print and on video have been working to include the stories from all sides in war. As often as not, you will hear the Japanese soldiers' view, as in the movie Letters from Iwo Jima, or the Viet Cong soldiers' experience in documentaries about the Nha Trang Valley. It is only when we begin to hear the stories of sacrifice and suffering, of courage and bravery from the other side, that we can begin to grasp the frustrating futility and the tremendous human cost of war. In World War II, 60 million people died. Only a small percentage of those were in uniform. On Remembrance Day, we honor those who heeded the call of nation, willingly or not, to serve as soldiers, as peacekeepers, or as support persons. We must also honor the lives of those unwillingly caught in the middle of wars. Lest We Forget is a motto honoring the dead, but it is also a call to keep the lessons of history before us. We may never be able to end war, but ceremonies such as Remembrance Day and exploring the impact of war on the other side may at least help us commit to trying every course of action short of war to resolve difference. The second extract comes from a sermon Reverend Kylie delivered in his church, the Unitarian Church of Edmonton, in 2012. So this was on Remembrance Day of 2012. Once in a while, we Unitarians discover we are not as free-thinking as we would like to believe ourselves to be. Once in a while, we discover that there are some ideas that are not so acceptable. There are areas of potential conflict. The subject of war is one of those areas. Wars happen. And when they do, nations and peoples are often drawn into the conflict, sometimes reluctantly, and sometimes enthusiastically. There are times when diplomacy does not succeed and one group decides to use force to get their way, to be the bully. And what then is the right response? That's the tricky part. Wisdom from the world's religions says, "Thou shalt not kill," in many ways. They say, "Don't fight," but we do. The sources portion of our statement of principles calls us to look for guidance from many places. One of them is words and deeds of prophetic women and men, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. The transforming power of love might suggest a peaceful response, but confronting powers and structures of evil with justice does not necessarily mean giving up violence. It could well be that compassion for the victims of violence actually stirs up violence within us. There are awful choices which nations, leaders, and individuals must make. Someone will always pay the price when violence is unleashed. The choice is often about who and how many will pay, and what kind of physical, psychological, and emotional prices will be inflicted. When one party in a conflict sees aggression and violence as a legitimate means of asserting their aims, what are the rest of us to do? Some will claim that it is better to be alive and enslaved than to be dead. There are some who claim that wars cause enormous numbers of civilian casualties, so-called collateral damage. There are some who claim that warfare begets warfare, and that subsequent generations of vanquished rise to start new wars. That's sometimes true, but not always. Japan and Germany have been peaceful nations since 1945, largely because the victors tried to create a so-called just peace. And yet, when we look at some of the recent conflict zones in the world, we see places where the United Nations, united in quotation marks, have chosen either not to intervene or to intervene in extremely limited ways. There's been genocide in Bosnia, 10,000 dead, 25,000 expelled. In Darfur, 300,000 dead, 80% through disease and starvation. In Rwanda, 800,000 dead. And in Cambodia, 1.7 million dead. The other solution to that generation rising problem appears to be make sure there is no next generation to rise against you. It seems that diplomacy, sanctions, peaceful protest, and silent witness may be no more effective in preserving civilian life than is armed intervention. In the face of armed conflict, there are no good solutions. There is only a choice between bad ones. Remembrance Day is a day to put aside these challenges. It is a time just to pause, to stop worrying about the big picture, and to concentrate for a while on the very small picture. The picture of one stone, one grave, one soldier at a time, and to shed tears for people we will never know. It is a day to understand that for whatever reason, there have been wars that have involved people we knew, perhaps people we loved. It is not a day to question why they were there, or whether or not it was a good idea. We have 364 days for those debates. Remembrance Day is instead a day to appreciate what they must have endured, to briefly contemplate their suffering, and perhaps their terror, if we can. So those were the two sermons that Reverend Kiley delivered, an excerpt from those. And I would invite you now to, if you have any thoughts or stories that you'd like to relate, we could share. And we'll start off with Joe.
I just wanted to point out that in Canada's last 150 years, we have always been the aggressor. We have always been fighting people who did not want war with us. There isn't a single war that we participated in where the people wanted to war with Canada. They would have done almost anything to avoid it. And that what bothered me was listening to Peter Mansbridge two or three nights ago, in which he stated that our freedom here was the result of our war efforts in the past. I would argue that not one microscopic particle of our freedom resulted from any of our participations in any war in the last 150 years.
Thinking about the part about wars in Brian Carley's sermons, that wars we don't think of as wars because they're not sort of famous. Well, I'm here because of war. My mother came from Karelia, which used to be part of Finland, but is now part of Russia. So I can never go to where my mother was born to see where she came from. And also, as many of you know, and you've probably heard me say this so many times, you can almost anticipate what I'm going to say, that I volunteer at the library. And many of the people that I work with who are trying to get a little bit better at English and so forth come from war countries. And there's one in particular that I'm sure I've mentioned before who comes from Somalia. And there are three women in her family, but there are no men. Those men are dead.
So often when we speak of Remembrance Day, we speak of the dead. And we sometimes don't speak about the wounded, the maimed, the desperate people whose lives are never the same after they come home from an adventure in bloodshed that they may have never expected to be what it was. Just to put a personal face on it, because I wrote about this for my writing group last week, my memory of my uncle coming home from the war. I was 3 years old, and we went to the train station, and the big, puffing, loud, noisy train pulled up, and this great big man got off wearing a uniform, and I didn't know him because he'd been away. He'd been overseas. Well, my mother always said he never came back. He was there, all right, but he wasn't the same man. He never was her brother in the same way again. And I think it's important to think about, sometimes is it worse for those people who died and their families, or for some of the terrible things that they come back with?
My father was in the Second World War in North Africa. He was stationed at a place called Tobruk. When I grew into my late teens, I wanted to know what was happening up in Tobruk. As a child, for me, it was just a glamorous thing, you know, wearing a uniform and all that, defeating the enemy. He never wanted to speak to me about it. There were 11 children in our family. He never even wanted to speak to any of us about it. There were only occasions when there was something similar to a Remembrance Day in the community. And they would come together, the old veterans from there, from North Africa. But we children were kept out of earshot. They didn't want us to hear what had happened there. Just now and then, Field Marshal Rommel and his tragedies against Montgomery, who let my father stand on parade for 3 hours in the hot desert sun, and he never came to take a salute. That's the only thing my father told me. He was deeply disappointed in Montgomery. He came and there stood 3 hours in the hot sun, and he never came to take a salute. He simply made for the officer's mess to get drunk.
I just want to mention that my husband said that I had never lived. He wouldn't talk about the war. He wouldn't do anything about the war. He said I didn't know anything about it. I was 12. He was 22. He volunteered, and he was in the. He was on the front line. He was doing computers, not computers. Sorry, radar. And he was taught to fight, but he didn't because he was doing. He was repairing radar, and he said he saw dead bodies lying about. He said he, other than that, he wouldn't talk about it at all. And as far as he's concerned, I had never lived. I didn't know anything about it. Although, as I said, I knew about bombing, I knew about radar, I knew about rationing and all that kind of thing, because I was 11 or 12. But I was never on the front line.
I sometimes cringe at the word collateral damage. It sounds so sanitary, but what it is hundreds and hundreds and millions of people killed, you know, human beings killed. And the figures are that the longer war goes on, the more technological it becomes, the more collateral damage there is. And there's a recent uncovering by Jeremy Scahill of the drones attacks, the information released by a whistleblower, showing all of the faulty information that goes on when a decision is made to kill somebody with a drone, and the tremendous number of human beings that are killed by accident, so-called.
I just wanted to say one more thing. As when I was looking at the sermons, the Brian Kiley sermons, 60 million people, the Second World War. 60 million. I mean, when we really think about that, you know, it just made me think about when you talk about collateral damage. I mean, we think about the soldiers and so forth and so on, but my goodness, that's nearly twice the population of Canada when you really think about it. That's a lot of damage.
I'll come to you in a moment there, Sally. I just... hearing you talk, Archie, about your father and others who have said the same thing, that the men didn't want to talk about what they saw. And I have to wonder if they did, whether in fact the next generation would be less likely to start wars. Maybe we do need to talk about it.
My father was a teenager, and he was going to go to the First World War. And the problem was he had long toes, and the shoes don't fit quite right. And so in order to go, he had one out of each foot taken out, so that because they weren't good shoes, they weren't made for everybody. They were like a box, and but he wanted to go, so he gave one on each side for the world.
Wow.
something that has been crossing my mind a lot in the last year, I guess, is the concern that I have now. I heard an interview with someone on the radio who talked about the problem of alliance. And when we ally with somebody, we create a war way bigger than what started the war. And good intentions to help people who are living lives of oppression and desperation, we go in to help, but actually what we do is we spread the war. And with the new government in Canada and the recent withdrawal of the bombers, the flights, I've thought that's a good start. Stop that. And maybe the peacekeeping efforts, even though they might take a lot of money, I think keeping people apart who are going to fight is worth it.
Thank you, Sandra. And of course, that goes to Joe's point that, for example, in the Second World War, Germany didn't declare war on us. We declared war on them because of the politics of the day. And the other thing that's common here is that of all the people that were involved, they really had very little, if any, participation in the actual decision to go to war. It was their fearless government leaders that sat at home and made the decisions and didn't see any battlefield action themselves, but they were willing to send the young people in their country off to war.
And I wish I could remember the quotation, but it has something to do with, you know, somebody came for my friend or whatever, and nobody went to his aid. And you go through two or three variations of that, and then finally somebody came for me and there was nobody left to help me. Who's helping the people in Syria right now? Had Hitler conquered all of Europe, would he then have come to America and Canada? It's not a simple situation.
Well, boy, we could have a real good discussion on that one, but we don't have time. But absolutely, there is an argument there.
Oh. Do we have time for one more?
We've got lots of time.
I have to say, I know my knowledge of how wars started, etc., is probably limited, but I do remember growing up in the United States when the Vietnam War was on, and I don't know how much I'm saying is actual factual, but I do remember that when they had the draft, people are sent to war that don't want to fight also. I mean, there was the draft, they picked, I think, a large number of poverty-stricken black men that had no jobs, and they took those. And then there was the low-income people in receipt of welfare. They looked at those people and drafted them first. And then it was young men who weren't in college or universities took those. And a lot of those people did not want to fight in a war that they had nothing to do with. So, yes, maybe we do go to wars to help other people, but we go to wars that we should have keep our nose out of. That was a war that nobody won.
While we've been talking, or I've been listening to you, I've been thinking of my grandfather, I never met him, he died before I was born, but and he was a pacifist, but when World War II started, I remember my dad telling me that his dad said that Hitler had to be stopped, so he was too old to actually just go to war, but he taught gunnery, he did gunnery training at Moss Bank.
Oh, we'll let Joe have, he's got another thought here.
Okay, the last word?
Okay,
or
yes.
Should I just need to know if I should keep walking. Or...
Okay, I think we'll let Joe have the last word.
I just wanted to say that one of the things that troubles me greatly about war is that none of the people at the top who make the wars are ever called to account.
Yeah.
And they sit there in their safe enclaves back home, and kill people by the millions. I guess the Vietnam War was one of the ones that really troubled me. That, you know, this was about the most useless war I think in all of history, and yet nobody is ever called to account for that.
And you know, and that goes to Bev's point about all the poor and disadvantaged black people and other ethnicities that went. And you look at the other side and you discover George W. Bush got a nice plum position in the Texas Air National Guard rather than going to Vietnam. His dad pulled those strings. So the unfairness is obvious.